Okay, if you happen to be combing your hair right now, and you just might because it's morning, put down that comb. Our correspondent Robert Krawich has something you need to know.
Call it, if you like, the baldness gap. There's no obvious explanation for this, but we're going to start with the Russians.
Okay, well, one of the odd things about baldness is there's a strange pattern in the history of Russia. Now, what this means, I have absolutely no idea.
But when you look at portraits of Russia's leaders since 1917, just look at their photos, which is what Stephen Jones, head of the biology department at the University College in London, did one day, you see this startling pattern.
You have an amazing regularity. Lenin was bald, Stalin was hairy, Khrushchev was bald, Brezhnev was hairy, Andropov was bald, Chernenko was hairy, Gorbachev was bald, Yeltsin was hairy, Putin was bald, and Medvedev, believe it or not, is hairy. Now, what that means, I honestly do not know.
But the pattern is so on and off, so even and so rhythmic, you could almost dance to it.
Lenin was bald.
But Stalin was hairy.
Khrushchev was bald.
But Brezhnev was hairy.
Andropov bald.
Chernenko hairy.
Gorbachev bald.
Yeltsin hairy.
Putin is bald.
Medvedev is hairy.
They switch back and forth. The pattern is scary. Hey. Bald.
Stalin hairy.
Khrushchev bald.
Brezhnev hairy.
Gorbachev bald.
Yeltsin hairy.
Putin bald. Medvedev hairy.
Okay. So having firmly established now that half Russia's leaders have been bald,
it does open the question as to, I mean, why have there been no bald American presidents? Certainly, since Eisenhower, there haven't been.
Well, there was Gerry Ford. He was bald-ish, but Ford was not elected, I know. And of course, there are a lot of baldies out there.
It's really quite common.
Right, but we don't choose them because...
Many people say because that's because bald men are less attractive.
Yeah, but in a year when so many pioneers have broken through, women, men over 70, blacks, Mormons, Jews, the only semi-bald man seeking higher office, Senator Joe Biden, he decided a few years ago to get himself unbalded, so there is still a baldness barrier.
Which is really quite strange.
And embarrassing to discover that instead of a missile gap like we used to have with Russia, in 2008 we have a baldness gap. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Lenin was bald.
But Stalin was hairy.
Khrushchev was bald.
But Brezhnev was hairy.
Andropov bald.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. And while you were sleeping, the world's most powerful particle accelerator rumbled to life at the CERN laboratory in Europe. The experiment is gargantuan in scale. It inhabits a 17-mile tunnel that runs underneath farmland in Switzerland and France. The hopes are equally grand for what it might uncover about the subatomic world. NPR's David Kestenbaum joins us now to talk about what happened really just a little while ago. David, good morning.
Good morning.
What happened?
Well, this is a particle collider. So the idea is you smash together subatomic particles and see what comes out. So you have to get the particles up to very high speeds. And to do that, they built the underground 17-mile tunnel. It's sort of like a circular racetrack. And this morning, they put some particles in the racetrack, and they sent them all the way around the circle. We have some audio. It sounded like this.
Okay. Three, two, one, go.
Two spots. Fantastic. That's really fantastic.
You can see there wasn't much time between the 3-2-1 and the applause, and that's because the particles are moving at close to the speed of light, so it just takes a tiny fraction of a second to go around. There's going to be a long shakedown period. They won't be actually taking data just yet, but this has been years in the making.
Okay, so let's talk about how big this is. You've been there. Give us a sense.
It's really, everything about it is just insanely large. If you wanted to shoot a science fiction movie, you don't have to bring any props. It's all there. So I went to see one of the detectors, which is the pieces of equipment to monitor the collisions. And to get there, you kind of drive through farmlands. You park in a parking lot. There's a nondescript hangar-like building. You go inside, and then there's this hole in the ground, and it's pristine sort of white-walled hole going down something like 300 feet. And you take an elevator down. At the bottom of that hole, what they've lowered down, is a huge, like, 7 stories high or something piece of scientific equipment, and there are people crawling all over it. You could actually get lost in it. There are a series of, like, trap doors and ladders. I mean, it's just everything about this is just insanely gigantic.
Well, you know, one of the tabloid versions of this and how a lot of people have heard about it is that the fear that it might create a black hole that would devour the Earth and maybe everything around it. But in fact, this particle accelerator might be able to create miniature black holes. And, you know, is it a good idea?
It's true. I mean, they'd be very excited if they made black holes. There's no danger that it's going to destroy the Earth. There's actually a website called something like, "Has the LHC Destroyed the Earth?" And if you go to it, there's just a big word that says no. But,
that's reassuring.
Yes, you can trust the web. Black holes are a long shot. They would evaporate instantly. But there's a whole list of weird things that predicted they might see. One is this mysterious particle called the Higgs, which would help explain why things have mass. You've probably never wondered about that. Or dark matter, the particles that astronomers see tugging on the galaxies but are sort of invisible. They might actually make these here. So they won't know for a bit, but those are the things on the list.
This experiment is costing something like $8 billion. Scientists from more than 80 countries are involved. Right. In just that way, why did it and how did it get so big?
You know, in some ways, they're sort of a victim of their own success, the physicists here, because they have this model of the subatomic world that has been fantastically successful to like 10 decimal places. It predicts everything you see. And so in previous smaller experiments, they see interesting things, but the model works really well. And what's interesting about this experiment is that it really pushes their understanding of the basic building blocks of the universe to the breaking point, where they feel like they're definitely going to have to see something new. I asked one scientist, what if you don't see anything? He said, well, I'll cry, but I don't think that will happen. I'm confident we will see something.
David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR science correspondent David Kestenbaum. And today, scientists at the European Organization for Nuclear Research successfully completed the first major test in an experiment aimed at understanding the building blocks of the universe.
Well, speaking of pork, we now have some thoughts on the phrase that sent the political world buzzing overnight. Yesterday, Barack Obama said this about John McCain.
So I guess his whole angle is, watch out, George Bush. Except for economic policy, healthcare policy, tax policy, education policy, foreign policy, and Karl Rove-style politics, we're really going to shake things up in Washington. That's not change.
And then he invoked the wisdom of barnyard cosmetology.
You know, you can put lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig.
Well, the McCain campaign promptly accused Obama of sexism. They turned out a TV ad saying that Obama was referring to Sarah Palin, who has talked famously about lipstick herself.
You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull, lipstick.
But today, Obama expressed outrage.
The McCain campaign would much rather have the story about phony and foolish diversions than about the future.
But the blogs, radio, TV were already ablaze with this debate, a common expression, the Obama supporters said, and we wondered, how common? Well, Senator McCain said this about Hillary Clinton's health care plan this year.
I think they put some lipstick on the pig, but it's still a pig.
Dick Cheney aimed the phrase at John Kerry's campaign in 2004.
You can put all the lipstick you want on a pig, but at the end of the day, it's still a pig.
And then there was New York Democrat Charles Rangel speaking of a tax bill also in 2004.
You can put lipstick on a pig, but you can't call it a lady.
And we have found instances of many other politicians, Democrats and Republicans, speaking the truth about pigs and lipstick. Now the real test. Has anyone actually put lipstick on a pig? Well, joining us from Swope, Virginia, where he's co-owner of Polyface Farms, is Joel Salatin. Welcome to the program, Mr. Salatin.
Thank you. I'm not really with you. I'm out here in the field with the pigs.
I gather you have both a pig and some lipstick?
Yes, sir. I've got some ruby red here in my pocket, and I've got about 50 pigs here that are coming up around me. Here's a black and white one. Come here, pig. Come here, pig. Well, it's kind of like putting lipstick on a hairbrush. You know, they don't have much lip.
Have you done it already?
Yeah, it's mainly nose here.
Aha. Uh-huh.
They seem to want to eat it.
Well, have you managed to get any of the lipstick on the pig?
Well, yeah.
Does the pig look any better with the lipstick on him? for her.
No, they really don't. Now, you know, if you put a cummerbund around his loins and some Birkenstocks on his hooves, it might improve him a little bit.
Well, Joel Salatin, I just want us to agree here. I can't see what you've done, but I assume that no harm was done to any animal in the making of this story.
No, in fact, they really didn't like it, and they've all gone and started lying down. So I think I bored them.
Perhaps they're smart animals. Mr. Salatin?
They are indeed.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's Farmer Joel Salatin of Swope, Virginia, demonstrating that indeed you can put lipstick on a pig, probably on its nose, but it is still a pig.
If there is nothing so lovely as a tree, in a city there aren't many things that can be as destructive, and summer storms can bring out the killer instinct. It's a painful reality for people who live in cities known for their tree canopies. Washington, D.C. is one. There, NPR's Larry Abramson asks, can city residents coexist with the trees they love?
This is Barnaby Woods, my neighborhood for nearly 20 years. I can still remember the first time my wife and I got out of the car here. We craned our necks and marveled at the huge oaks and maples overhead. They stretch from one side of the street and touch the trees on the other side. At least they used to.
I'm amazed at the fact that you lost these trees over this last few years. I mean, really, it's sort of like just very bad luck.
Local arborist Keith Pitchford remembers how my street used to look. 3 years ago, he helped my neighbors and me save some of those trees from the hands of Pepco. The local power company wanted to cut down a dozen bad actors, trees that kept rubbing up against power lines, causing regular blackouts. We won that battle, but we lost the war.
We're looking at the end of sort of a climax forest age, where the bigger trees are starting to die and fall, and the younger trees are coming up.
In the past few years, storms, old age, and disease have killed many of the giants. One came down this past June and took out power for 3 days. Keith Pitchford says the titans that were planted here 80 years ago have had it.
I think you had mostly northern red oaks or scarlet oaks along here, yeah.
Oh, it hurts to hear him talk about my trees in the past tense. But the signs are undeniable. The shade garden we planted years ago is getting burnt to a crisp as the shade givers bite the dust. Earlier this summer, a particularly macho storm tore through town and took out this gorgeous silver maple in the Georgetown section of D.C. It looks like some arboreal traffic accident. This majestic tree lies splayed across an entire intersection. On the way down, it dealt a fatal blow to two of its brethren. The other trees are still standing, but D.C. arborist John Thomas says they will have to be put down.
Once a tree of this size, a 40-inch tree or a mature tree, gets damaged to this level, it'll be unstable. It'll produce vegetative growth that's not structurally sound. The best thing is to get it out and get it replanted and get the new tree going.
And then I'd just be curious about replanting.
Yeah,
and
we'll
when
automatically
we can get on.
Go back on the list in this fall.
Will it? So you think it'll happen this fall?
Oh, yeah.
Susie Kupka, a neighbor, asked Thomas how long it will take to replace this tree. She is clearly sad at the loss, but other residents also get hopping mad when they lose power for days. They ask, why weren't these trees removed earlier? John Thomas says you have to pick your priorities.
I think it's what do we want to live with as a society? Are we willing to lose power and lose stuff in our refrigerator and sitting with candles? But do we want a canopy out in front of our house and along our sidewalks?
The big trees of Washington are a big problem for Nathan McElroy, a forester for local power supplier Pepco.
The trees are so big, there's no room to move the wires. And they're burning. They're coming in direct contact with these huge trees.
McElroy is out at a work site on the edge of the city. There was no storm here. This is preventive maintenance. McElroy is supervising a contractor who is delicately pruning some scarlet and willow oaks.
We're trying to prevent leaders from establishing themselves through the phases, through the energized conductors.
In arborees, that means McElroy is trying to train the tree to stay away from the power lines. When wire meets tree, the results can be spectacular.
And you could see it was burning very gradually over many years.
McElroy holds up a charred branch from a tree that got too big for its britches. I've seen where this can lead. Twice, the big tree in front of my house caused the power line to snap. A live wire danced on my front lawn for many uncomfortable minutes, spewing sparks like a fire hose. The thing was so hot, it turned soil into glass. That's why Pepco and other power companies are so passionate about trimming trees often and taking down those that get out of hand. Spokesman Clay Anderson.
We do not look at the tree as something that is we're trying to harm. Safety is a prime concern.
There was a time when I would have rolled my eyes at that statement. Back in 2005, Pepco crews planned to give my neighborhood trees a crew cut without even telling the residents. I saw the utility people as brutes who just wanted to save themselves the trouble of dealing with downed trees after storms. My neighbors and I got the utility to x-ray some trees. Many turned out to be healthy and were spared. But as trees continue to die, it's clear we need a long-term solution to the collision between trees and power lines. Some arborists say there is an answer.
Planting the proper tree in this space, like, for instance, the amber maple that we installed in front of your house.
Earl Utzler is an arborist for the city of Washington. He helped pick some replacement trees after the battle on Barnaby Street. Proper tree, proper place is the motto for the city's plan to replace tall trees under power lines with species that are more cooperative.
Here's a good example of these are purple leaf plums that were planted along where elms have been removed.
Earl Utzler takes me for a drive in his little natural gas-powered car down a Washington street. He points to a strip of perfectly respectable trees that will never cause any problems for the power company.
They're starting to establish themselves. You know, these here that are already, say, 15 feet are going to get another 10 feet tall, and that's going to be it.
They're not really providing shade in the sense that, you know, you can go out and sit with your neighbors on the street under a tree like that. It's just not the same experience.
You're entirely right. It is different, but it's more manageable. It's less dangerous.
City foresters encourage residents who want tall trees to plant them closer to houses and away from the power lines. But small city lots mean you may have to plant uncomfortably close to home. Many cities are moving in the direction of shorter trees under power lines. Phoenix, for example, recently inventoried 17,000 trees. 12,000 were found to be problem species threatening the electric grid. They will be gradually replaced with the right tree in the right space. Back on Barnaby Street, arborist Keith Pitchford says new communities can learn from all of this. They can plan ahead and avoid these conflicts. But it's a lot harder for older, established neighborhoods like mine.
And everyone wants to put the power lines underground or something, but, you know, if they buried them underground, they'd be cutting all the roots of the trees we're trying to preserve because they'd want to put them under the sidewalk. Ultimately, we're going to have to live with smaller canopy trees under the power lines and bigger trees on the other side of the road.
Pitchford says he wishes it weren't so. Me, I can't help myself. Sometimes I go up to the puny amber maple, which the city planted in place of a huge oak, and I whisper to that tree, "Think big." Larry Abramson, NPR News.
It's not that easy being green, having to spend each day the color.
The sound of the season for many football fans, the glorious call to Monday Night Football. While that audience does include many women who love the game, many others experience something rather different. Our weekly sports commentator has a diagnosis and perhaps a cure.
Yes, it's that time again when so many American women are having their space invaded, their sensitive environment contaminated by alien emotions.
Oh, that awful torment has started to affect me once more. It's that same sort of distress that always seems to strike me at exactly this time of the year.
Hi, I'm Frank DeFord, and yes, if you, like so many women, are beginning to suffer from those agonizing seasonal pains, I'm here to tell you about a wonderful new product, Pigskinexia.
Pigskinexia?
Yes, Pigskinexia. I know it's only the beginning of football season, but are you already having to endure the shame of that gridiron malady that is so common in so many American homes? regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, or intelligence. Pigs Connexia not only filters out of your system all football noises and associated rude behaviors, but it also soothes as it washes away those awful weekend hours when ugly male chromosomes dominate the household. Pigs Connexia is safe. It only attacks American football. Its patented ingredients allow baseball, basketball, hockey moms, tennis, soccer, professional wrestling, American Idol, and all other civilized entertainments to enter your consciousness, just as always, leaving you and your loved ones to enjoy the rest of the American dream, just as we've all been promised.
Wow, with Pigs Connexia, Frank, I can live as joyously in the autumn just as I do in the spring, winter, and summer.
Exactly. You'll be able to take your weekends back and your Monday nights, too. Pigs Connexia is easy to use. It comes in tablet, poison pill, or convenient personal injection form. Ask your doctor about Pigs Connexia.
Gee, Frank, thanks for the tip. I'm calling my doctor today.
Now, Pigs Connexia may not be for everyone. If you experience torment brought on by football for more than 4 hours, call your marriage counselor. And if you continue to suffer from long pregame shows, screaming, beer burping, point spreads, tailgating, and other forms of gridiron excess, better you stop taking Pigs Connexia, protect the children and the dog, and just cope the best you can till the Super Bowl is over.
Advice from commentator Frank DeFord. He joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Thanks also to our colleague, Melissa Gray. She plans her fall weekends around the Georgia Bulldogs. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
Even at $223 million, the earmarks for the bridge that was supposed to connect Ketchikan to Gravina Island, Alaska, population roughly 50, has had remarkably durable legs as a campaign issue. Every day, another news organization affirms that Sarah Palin was for it before she was against it. And every day, she repeats that she told Washington, thanks, but no thanks.
I told Congress, thanks, but no thanks on that bridge.
I did tell Congress, thanks, but no thanks for that bridge.
I told the Congress, thanks, but no thanks on that bridge to nowhere.
One reason this is so important to the GOP is that as late as 2006, Palin was taking a very Alaskan view of the bridge project.
I'm not going to stand in the way of progress that our congressional delegation, in the position of strength that they have right now, they're making those efforts for the state of Alaska to build up our infrastructure. I would not get in the way of progress.
But by that time, John McCain had long since seized upon the Alaska Bridge as the epitome of all that's wrong with Washington. When I watched him campaign in South Carolina almost a year ago, it was the centerpiece of his pitch.
The tipping point, my friends, was the $233 million bridge in Alaska to an island with 50 people on it, the so-called Bridge to Nowhere. One Sunday, not that couple of years ago, on the front of Parade, the insert in everybody's Sunday newspaper was the picture of the bridge.
That Parade magazine cover was published in November 2005. So the tipping point, according to McCain, was a year before Palin ran in Alaska supporting the bridge. And in fact, John McCain had picked up on the Bridge to Nowhere more than a year before that. Keith Ashdown, the chief investigator for the watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense, is credited with naming the bridge. It started in 2002, he says, when he got a tip about a huge pork barrel project.
We spent several months trying to figure out, you know, how could we make this sexy, so to speak, for the lower 48 states and for the news media. And one night, I had a couple beers in me, and I got a little more creative, and I came with the term Bridge to Nowhere.
2004, April 10th, 2004, an article appears in the New York Times in which you're quoted. Tell me about that.
Tim Egan, he's a New York Times reporter who's an expert in Alaska, all things Alaska, and he had read our write-up on the bridge, and he contacted me, and he said he wanted to do a story on it. He wrote this excellent piece, which I think basically was its introduction to the national audience. And it basically put a bunch of things in motion. And it introduced a really bad project on the front page of the New York Times to the public.
Describing it as
The Bridge to Nowhere.
Called by its critics The Bridge to Nowhere. That was April 10th. The following day, April 11th, 2004, John McCain goes on Meet the Press. He's interviewed by the late Tim Russert and talks about ending Pork Barrel Project's wasteful spending.
Well, now we're employing a strategy of guns and pork. Look at the highway bill. It had 3,000 Pork Barrel projects on it, including Bridges to Nowhere in Alaska. So we're going to have to make some tough choices.
You must have felt like you just completed a touchdown pass.
I thought it was done.
This phrase has been caught by someone aspiring to the White House.
Yeah, you know, the senator has been committed to cutting wasteful spending for a long time, and I think it coalesced a lot of things that he had seen into one word.
Senator McCain has been assailing the Bridge to Nowhere as the epitome of what's wrong with Washington ever since the spring of 2004. In November 2006, Sarah Palin is elected, and from what we can tell, she was supporting it.
Right. As anyone running for statewide office in Alaska, to oppose a project like this would have been political suicide. And she actively was an advocate for it, you know, wearing shirts that said, "I'm from Nowhere, Alaska," to saying, "We have to support our congressional delegation, their efforts to bring money back to our state." That's progress, is the term she used.
Ultimately, though, the earmark was changed. It no longer was dedicating this $223 million to the bridge from Ketchikan to Gravina Island, but Alaska still got the money.
That's right. The next year, they changed the language, and it redirected it to Alaska, but it wasn't earmarked legally to that one project.
Today, Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, Republican of South Carolina, writes an op-ed page piece in the Wall Street Journal, which he says, she was for it, but then after she realized the problem with earmarks, Governor Palin was against it. She killed the bridge and saved taxpayers' money.
The senator is a friend of taxpayers, but that's an incorrect statement. It was good that this project was killed by Governor Palin, but it's not correct that it saved any money. It's redirected the money to other alternatives in Alaska and has gone to one project that's on the Gravina Island. It's a road project.
Well, was there any moment in Governor Palin's handling of this appropriation that can be construed as her saying thanks but no thanks?
No. She killed the bridge to nowhere. That is correct. To say thanks but no thanks would imply that they didn't take the money, and they got every dime of it.
That's Keith Ashdown of Taxpayers for Common Sense talking with us about the bridge to nowhere, a term that he is credited with coining for the notorious Alaska earmark.